Moses was the kind of guy who never went looking for trouble. But it always seemed to have a way of coming looking for him. He's born at an inopportune time and nearly gets killed for it when Pharaoh decrees that all newborn Hebrew boys be thrown into the Nile. As a young man tending sheep in the land of Midian, he wanders up Mount Sinai and sees a bush that blazes with fire but is not consumed. Turning off the path to look at it, he walks into the trouble of a lifetime. God speaks to Moses, saying he is to lead the Israelites out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. Moses offers a series of unenthusiastic responses, starting with, "Who, me?" God's response is something like, "Yes, you. Now, go tell the Israelites you're representing me." Moses asks, "But what if they don't believe me and won't listen to me?" God replies, "I'll give you the power to perform some miracles. That'll convince them." Moses protests, "But I'm terrible at public speaking." This is in the scripture, by the way. It's not the NRSV, it's the PRSV, the Presbyterian Revised Standard. God says something like, "Forget about that public speaking stuff, just get going." Moses begs, "Please choose somebody else." God gets irritated and has the last word. "Your brother Aaron has a pretty good mouth on him. He can be your spokesman. Now quit making excuses." So Moses returns to Egypt, leaving his wife and children in Midian. He and Aaron visit Pharaoh and give him the "Let my people go" speech. Pharaoh gets angry and makes life even worse for the Israelites. Moses comes back to God, protesting that his own people are ignoring him and asking, "How can he be expected to get anywhere with Pharaoh?" Once again, God orders him back into action. After the visitation of 10 plagues upon the Egyptians and a few other skirmishes, Moses prevails. The Israelites are released. This dance of doubt and faith continues for the next 40 years as Moses engineers the exodus of the Israelites and their long trek through the desert. With each hardship, the Israelites complain bitterly and blame Moses. "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness?" they ask, as the Egyptians pursue them toward the Sea of Reeds. They give names like Test and Quarrel to the places of their encampments. At one point, they veer toward open rebellion and talk of going back to Egypt. "Egypt, the land of fish and meat and melons and cucumbers and garlic. And slavery." Moses is unwavering with them, but anguished in the privacy of his prayers to God. After decades of travail, God tells him he will not live to see the Promised Land, that his lieutenant Joshua will lead the people in. Moses is taken to a mountain overlooking the River Jordan and dies there. Moses is an icon of faith. A millennium after the Exodus, the Apostle Paul included Moses in a description of a cloud of witnesses to the importance of faith. And then he declared, "Faith is evidence of things not seen." A puzzling, fascinating statement. In reference to that cloud of witnesses, Paul was saying that those witnesses testified with their lives to the existence of things we cannot observe with our five senses. Moses' great leap of faith was evidence of what? Of the existence of God? But God is highly visible in the Exodus story. holding up his end of a very intense dialogue about religious leadership, causing miracles and calamity, and otherwise behaving as we expect a deity to behave in the ancient legends. What unseen something is proven by Moses' extraordinary leap? I say the existence and purpose and primacy of his own deep self. Call this soul or psyche or whatever you will. It is the part of us that dwells below rational calculation, far below any feeling in your gut, all the way down at the bottom of the mine shaft of the human persona. The deep self knows things about life's purpose of which the ego knows not. Faith is evidence of that unseen self and what it knows, which caused Moses to give himself to a purpose that could not be justified on rational grounds. Now, faith is real evidence of this unseen deep self only when expressed in purposeful action. Showy declarations of undying devotion pale by comparison. Their evidentiary weight is slight. Faith is not something we ought to go out and get in order to be morally superior or deserving. It cannot be prescribed as a spiritual nostrum, although ministers often talk that way. The command to have faith cannot be obeyed. The very idea of obedience is inimical to true faith, which is an expression of authenticity, not compliance. Acting on faith is evidence of a way of knowing that is radically different from everything we are taught by the materialist empirical tradition in which we live. That tradition says reality is known to us only by evidence that appeals to the senses. From the point of view of our rational minds, the statement that faith is evidence of things not seen is paradoxical. And yet, we do often speak of the importance of knowing ourselves. This only makes sense if there are two parts of us that don't know each other. Those two parts are ego and the deep self. Ego senses this state of disconnection as an undefined yearning for something missing. It may embark on all manner of pilgrimages in search of a solution. But as reflected in today's readings from Rumi and Hafiz, these pilgrimages will not bear fruit because the outward gaze of the pilgrim is misdirected. The yearning is coming from deep self, which is disturbing our emotions and ego with its struggle to gain expression in human life. Only a downward, inward journey by ego toward unity with deep self will satisfy the yearning. For most of us, the time for that downward, inward journey may not ripen for quite a while. The Jungian theologian James Hollis has said that the dominant question in the first half of life is, what does the world expect of me? This question concerns the demands of career and family and community and many other things. In the second half of life, Hollis says, the question shifts to a more profound one. What now does my soul expect of me? Ego must learn a new way of listening that enables deep self to be heard. It is a matter of spiritual practice. Otherwise, ego remains tragically arrested in the youthful business of getting and spending, making and unmaking social and material agreements with no deeper purpose than simply getting along in the world. If ego does not listen, it cannot know deep self. What it does not know, it cannot trust. And what it does not trust, it will not have faith in. Returning to the Exodus story, I ask you to read beyond the literary device of a conversation between Moses and God. I ask you to consider the possibility that the heroic challenge facing Moses is not having faith in God, but rather having faith in his own deep self. What if God had simply provided the mountain and the spiritual open space for this interior encounter between the Moses ego and the Moses self, and then stood by silently? What if we took the burning bush to be a symbol of Moses stepping not into God's presence, but rather into the presence of passion for the liberation of his own oppressed people, a passion shining bright as gold within his own soul? We're given a glimpse of this passion earlier in the Exodus story. As a young man, Moses intervenes to stop an Egyptian from beating a Hebrew slave and winds up killing him. Having let loose his passion for justice and liberation for one unguarded moment, though, he quickly corks it up again. He flees from Egypt into the land of Midian and becomes an inconspicuous shepherd, hiding out from possible reprisal, sure, but more profoundly, hiding out from his own purpose and destiny. This is the classic reaction of ego to the awesome power of deep self. And it is the classic reaction of deep self to ego not to let this matter rest. Its passion, like the burning bush, is inextinguishable. So Moses finds himself on the mountain with his two internal inhabitants locked in fierce debate over his destiny. The Moses ego insists that any mission must be manageable. The Moses self, on the other hand, has no patience for concerns with manageability. Its purpose, leading the Israelites out of bondage and into the promised land, is about as unmanageable as you can get. The Moses ego is filled with doubt and anxiety. It vexes over the risk of failure, possibly catastrophic failure. It is expressing its nature as a problem solver, a calculator of risks, a manager of uncertainties. The Moses self sweeps aside all such anxieties, questions, doubts, and demands for specifics as irrelevant. And from its point of view, they are. The Moses self is speaking like a man possessed. Possessed by a purpose with a capital P. This purpose is so defining of everything else that self views even the unsuccessful pursuit of it as noble. Better to die trying, says the self, than to abandon the pursuit. To the deep self, a life saved by abandoning this ultimate purpose would not be a life worth living. Purpose and self are one. Now, some of you undoubtedly are wondering where self got this purpose. Theologians have various answers for that, and some of the answers include the word God. For understanding faith, we can leave all of that aside. If we can't come to terms with faith in deep self, it is pointless to talk about God. There are two ways in which this mountainside confrontation between the ego and deep self of Moses can be resolved. The first is by ego coming to recognize that deep self, not ego, is the source of life's purpose. Then there can be an ordering of priorities that places spiritual purpose above the management of material existence. The result of this realignment is a life of great fulfillment, one that includes success and failure, joy and pain, life and death, and a powerful, inspiring experience of wholeness. Ego is included in this experience, because now it is managing toward a profound purpose and authentic self-expression. This is a role of far greater nobility and integrity than its old habit of reflexive problem-solving simply for the sake of muddling through life. This resolution does not guarantee conventional success, because now success means expression of self in service of its authentic purpose rather than some defined outcome. What it does assure, though, is a life without regret. Whatever difficulties and unhappinesses may arise, a person cannot regret being true to the life purpose inscribed on his own deep self. This resolution also does not eliminate doubt. In Isaac Dennison's novel, The Young Man with the Carnation, a young writer dithers over whom he should be trying to please and how, and whether it even makes sense to write anymore. God speaks to him, saying, "Come, I will make a covenant between me and you. I will not measure you out any more distress than you need to write your books. But you are to write the books, for it is I who want them written. Not the public, not by any means the critics, but me." "Can I be certain of that?" asks the writer. "Not always," responds God. And deep self would give the same response to ego's longing for certainty. "Not always." Doubt is often wrongly cast as the villain in heroic stories of faith, but doubt is the ground of all faith. It is only when rational calculation raises serious doubts that the active presence of faith can be seen. Ego will always have doubts. Deep self will always be certain. The only question that matters is who is in charge. The other way in which the confrontation between ego and self can be brought to an end is for ego to run with it. Ego can do this by burying itself in the endless trivialities of rudderless problem solving, or chasing after what is usually called happiness, a purpose enshrined in our culture from the Declaration of Independence right down to the present day. To rationalize these evasions, it will deny the very existence of deep self, or demonize it as some kind of internal, wrist-blind madman who absolutely must be kept locked up, muzzled. All of these amount to an unexamined life, which Socrates declared to be not worth living. I think Socrates was right, but what do you think? What's so bad, after all, about the pursuit of happiness? I would say nothing at all if it happens to coincide with your life's purpose. But there is a world of difference between happiness and fulfillment. Happiness is the presence of pleasure and good feelings, and the absence of pain and bad feelings. Fulfillment is deep self's authentic expression of a life's purpose. What will you do when these two goals diverge, as they are almost certain to do in every human life? Deep self will not surrender its purpose. How deep will your happiness be if your soul is waging a guerrilla war against it? A lot of people have told me to try to stay out of trouble in my life. I don't trust that kind of advice. I think the important thing is to get into the right kind of trouble. This is what the theologian James Hollis had in mind when he asked, "What if Jesus had followed his ego need for comfort? What if he had left Gethsemane and hopped the first camel out of town? What if Beethoven had settled for being a fat sausage instead of a man who wrestled with the gods? What if Gautama Buddha had been content to live forever in the pleasure palace his parents had created for him? And what about you and me? If we turned our backs on the purposes that are part and parcel of our own deep selves, could we honestly say we were really here at all? Or would we have turned our precious lives over to a kind of stand-in, programmed to get through life with a minimum of discomfort? So the choice between embrace of and flight from life's purpose is not some kind of special dilemma that applies only to great prophets and legends. All life purposes are of equal authenticity and equal value, whether recorded in history books or not. You may ask, how will you know when you've found your true life's purpose? You may ask, why should you even credit anything I've said about the existence of deep self when I can't prove it? Do you see that these questions are asked from a point of view, and that it is the point of view of ego? If deep self could speak, its answer would be, you will know you have found your life's purpose when you stop asking for an empirical test to confirm it. As many of you know, I'm a charter member of that left brain club Sherry mentioned in her testimony. So it's very surprising to find myself taking one big leap of faith after another these days. Even so, I don't expect the work of keeping my ego and my deep self aligned will ever be finished. But I'm betting on the power of my deep self to point my life in the right direction. And I will take every opportunity to bet on yours, too. I expect to find gold down there. If you've done any mining in this vein, I'd love to hear about it. If I told you I was getting a group together to make regular trips to the bottom of the mine shaft, would you join? Amen and blessed be.